Brian C. Wilson is professor in the Department of Comparative Religion at Western Michigan University. Previous publications include Yankees in Michigan and What is Religion? But today we are talking about his newest book, Dr. John Harvey Kellogg and the Religion of Biologic Living. Welcome, Brian. Let's begin with what drew you to writing this book. Originally, you were going to write simply about Battle Creek history?
That's correct. Yeah, I became fascinated with the religious history of Battle Creek. I came to Western in 1996 to take a job in the comparative religion department and decided that I would do a local research project. Part of it was just convenience, and part of it was coming from California, I had all sorts of kind of misconceptions about the cultural history of the Midwest, which I'm happy to say turned out to be completely wrong. And this was one way of kind of getting into the local community.
Okay.
But Battle Creek turned out to be fascinating because it was, in the 19th century, a small community for a variety of reasons that attracted all sorts of interesting new religious groups for the time. So there were Quakers, and they were Hicksite Quakers, so they were very liberal Quakers. Mm-hmm. There were Universalists, people who didn't believe in the reality of hell. There were Swedenborgians who followed the mystical teachings of the Swedish seer Emanuel Swedenborg. There are also freethinkers and deists, and all these people basically got along in Battle Creek. And at a certain point, a number of the Quakers became very interested in spiritualism, the idea that you can contact the spirits of the dead through the ritual of the seance. Mm. And this became, of course, a national craze after 1848. But it especially became fascinating for the Quakers, especially the Hicksite Quakers, the liberal Quakers. Mm-hmm. And so they basically converted en masse into spiritualists and created the first independent church, which was a spiritualist church, which thrived for years in Battle Creek. So Battle Creek, beginning in the late 40s, early 50s of the 19th century, had become a kind of mecca for kind of unconventional religiosity. So that was one of the things that really drew me to Battle Creek.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing about Battle Creek is you can't ignore the fact that it becomes the headquarters for the Seventh-day Adventist Church.
And yeah, I hadn't realized that part, that, you know, we all probably think of Battle Creek as a serial city, and that is a part of this story. But your story about the other brother actually has a lot to do with, as you're saying, religion, the Seventh-day Adventists. So tell us a little more about that.
Yeah, the Seventh-day Adventists descend from a movement called Millerism, which popped up in the Northeast in the 1820s and 1830s. And William Miller believed he'd kind of cracked the biblical code and could predict roughly the date of the end of the world, when the second coming would occur. And he convinced a lot of people with his logic that this was true. And so a lot of people kind of broke away from their existing churches and began to follow William Miller. Well, when the predicted date didn't occur, another date was set, and tensions were kind of ratcheted up after that. And finally, they decided it was going to be October 22nd, 1844. That was going to be the date. Mm. Well, that rolled around too, and of course, nothing happened. And the vast majority of Miller's followers essentially fell away. They lost confidence in him. And William Miller himself went back to his farm and retired, and that's pretty much the last we heard of him. But there are a number of people who believed something had happened on that date. Hmm. It just didn't happen on Earth. It happened in heaven. And so they developed this notion that Jesus in heaven, in the heavenly temple, had begun a process of cleansing the heavenly temple. And when he was finished with this process, then he would return for the second coming on Earth. So he was coming. It's going to be soon. And October 22nd, 1844 marked an important date, mm-hmm. you know, the beginning of this process, but it's only the beginning, not the end. So people who were willing to accept this idea came to call themselves Adventists. Advent just simply meaning arrival. Mm-hmm. And among those Adventists, there were some who decided that they were going to adopt the Saturday Sabbath. So instead of celebrating the Sabbath on Sunday, they would go back to the old Jewish Sabbath of Saturday. And that's why they're called the Seventh-day Adventist.
I see. And I remember in reading the book that there was even something in there about how his parents, the child when he was small, didn't have him learn how to read because they thought, well, what's the point?
In the early days, there was a high degree of expectation that the Second Coming was going to occur soon.
Yeah.
And so this always creates tensions because how far do you have to go to, you know, maintain your normal life if everything's going to get disrupted very quickly? And this is one of the stories that's told about Kellogg, that Kellogg's father thought, why bother sending my kid to school if the Second Coming is around the corner? Well, the movement, the Seventh-day Adventist movement, began evolving, and they did start to begin to create institutional structures for the long haul, and basically pushing back their expectations of the end a little bit farther away than they normally thought. And so education became a part of that. And luckily for John Harvey Kellogg, he did have some rudimentary elementary education, learned to read and write. And he himself was an autodidact. He just loved reading and learning.
Mm-hmm. So the history of Battle Creek doesn't begin with cereal. It begins with this sanitarium that Kellogg built and with this concept of biologic living. Explain to us what biologic living is.
Well, biologic living is the idea that just as God had created a series of moral laws to help us live in this life and to help us achieve salvation, the Ten Commandments, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
He also created a series of physical laws of the universe, laws that basically impact our bodies, and that we are obliged to follow the physical laws of health just like we're following the moral laws of the Ten Commandments. So in a lot of cases, Kellogg would refer to the greater Ten Commandments, and that included biologic living. And biologic living was this idea that you not only could live a moral life, but you also had to live physically a life that would essentially lead to what he called physiological righteousness.
Mm.
And in time, he came to believe that purity of body was just as important as purity of soul for one's ultimate salvation. And that's the key to biological living.
All right. So he saw the possibility of a perfect human being. Is that right? What was perfection to him? Well, I guess both on the religion side and the physical side. What did he see as the perfect human being?
Well, he did believe that God essentially had given human beings the resources to achieve perfection in this life, both spiritually and physically. Now, there had been a long strain of spiritual perfectionism in this country, and it starts with Charles Grandison Finney back in the early 19th century. So this wasn't a new idea, but Kellogg's idea that married to this concept, you could also have a perfect body, this was something new. And in fact, it was troubling to the leadership within the Seventh-day Adventist Church, because the leader of the church, the prophetess, Ellen G. White, always made it very clear that one should strive for bodily health, but perfection would never be achieved in this life.
Mm.
And it would not, that in itself would not impact one's salvation.
So how did he handle, say, disabled people?
Well, that was always a problem for him. It essentially... there was a certain amount of latitude based on your hereditary antecedents. And so some people, he realized, were going to be born with certain birth defects, and these were not going to be essentially correctable in this life, given any regime. So for them, it's a matter of suffering in this life, but ultimately would not be a stumbling block for salvation in the next. Now, for somebody who starts off with a clean slate and then spends a life smoking and drinking and being debauched and ruins their body, then they would be judged for this.
All right. his philosophy, his religion clashed often. Is that more his philosophy, or perhaps it was his personality? He seems to be a powerful personality. And in fact, at the end of the story, he is excommunicated from the church.
Yes, they call it disfellowshipping. Okay. And in 1907, the church, it was pretty much by mutual agreement. Kellogg and his brother, Will K. Kellogg, both were struck from the rolls of the Battle Creek Church. And the issues involved are pretty complex. Part of it's ego. John Harvey Kellogg has a tremendous ego and a tremendous sense of ambition and a tremendous sense of his own destiny. He's one of these people who really feels he has his own destiny. And he goes up against Ellen G. White, who, for her part, also has a tremendous sense of her own destiny. And in the beginning, they work together. But over time, of course, you have two charismatic persons within the church, and this becomes a point of friction. So there was that. Mm-hmm. Kellogg really wanted the Seventh-day Adventist Church to really focus completely on what he called medical missionary work. And he wanted the Seventh-day Adventist Church to pretty well downplay the kind of distinctive doctrinal things that made Seventh-day Adventism a sectarian movement and adopt primarily medicine as their way of proselytizing people. Ellen White, on the other hand, thought that this showed a lack of balance. The medical work was important, but the preaching the word of the end was even more important. So you had these kind of theological kinds of tensions between them. And then theologically, Kellogg always was concerned with reconciling his Seventh-day Adventism. He'd been brought up in it, in the heart of Seventh-day Adventism. Mm-hmm. He wanted to reconcile that with the kind of modern directions that science and medicine were going in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. So he was always torn. How much of his Adventism does he keep? How much does the kind of modern world impinge on his new worldview? And he worked very hard to come up with some kind of workable synthesis between the two. And in part, this entailed Seventh-day Adventists believe in a very concrete anthropomorphic God, a very concrete anthropomorphic Jesus, and they believe in a very concrete anthropomorphic life in heaven after death. For Kellogg, his vision of God was not anthropomorphic, but a personal God, but a God that basically pervaded the entire world. And in fact, God undergirded all the processes in the world, physical, biological, moral. He was always there. His power was always kind of undergirding everything that was going on. So he talked about God being the servant of man.
Interesting concept.
His ubiquity everywhere and basically holding up the fabric of the universe. And of course, those kinds of comments about God being the servant of man offended people like Ellen White, who wanted to protect the sovereignty and dignity of God. Yeah.
Yeah. So was this the beginnings of what today we call holistic living? Are there similarities there?
Oh, very definitely. And it actually antedates Dr. Kellogg himself, because in the early 19th century, there are a group of thinkers that historians later have called Christian physiologists. And these were people like William A. Andrus and Sylvester Graham. Sylvester Graham was a Presbyterian minister who believed that, again, diet was as important for the ultimate salvation of the soul as was sin or any kind of behavior.
And Kellogg was a vegetarian, wasn't he? Or a vegan, even.
Well, Kellogg was a vegan, yes. And he got this from Bronson, and he got this from Sylvester Graham and through Ellen White and her various visions. And the idea was that in the Garden of Eden, God had basically commanded Adam and Eve only to eat of vegetable foods. And the argument was that human beings only began to eat flesh after the flood because of the dearth of vegetable foods. Now, one of the interesting things is, if you read the Bible, you see that the patriarchs of those times had tremendously long lifespans, like Methuselah.
Yeah.
Thousands of years.
Yeah.
But after Noah and his kin begin eating flesh, you see a degeneration of the human race, and so the lifespans grow shorter and shorter and shorter. And this is something the Christian physiologist taught. This was something Ellen White taught. And this was something that John Harvey Kellogg believed wholeheartedly. So he believed that the vegetarian diet was easier on the body. It was commanded by God and would ultimately lead to longer and longer lifespans.
Hmm. Paint a picture in words for us of the sanitarium. This was quite an immense operation that he had. Not only the building, but didn't he have something like 400 acres where he grew this fresh food that
yes.
people ate? And so tell us what this place is like and what do we find today?
Oh, it would have been remarkable if we could kind of time travel back. It was the core of the building was a huge Victorian pile, and it was this wood building with brick veneer, so it looked very substantial. Subsequent events would show it wasn't, but and it was huge, and it housed hundreds of people. It had special rooms for hydropathy, for the water cure, special rooms for gymnastic exercises, special rooms for heating treatments, for light treatments. In the back, there were tennis courts and sandboxes for kids to play in. Kellogg was a big believer in exposure to full-spectrum light.
Mm-hmm.
There were also interesting amenities. There was a palm garden in the middle of it, which people would go and basically they wouldn't have high tea because there was no tea there, but they would have a tea substitute and essentially listen to a string quartet play for a while. There were dances occasionally. Mm. There was had kind of the atmosphere of a kind of posh European hotel.
Quite a resort.
Almost,
yeah.
Well, yes, and in fact, you not only had the outbuildings and the farmlands that were used to actually produce the food to supply the kitchens, but they even had cabins on Gogwak Lake, which is a little lake right outside of Battle Creek,
mm-hmm.
a little bit more rural, so if you got tired of being in the hospital, tired of being at, you know, in Battle
Creek.
At the
resort.
You could go off and be in the woods for a while in a nice little rented cabin and basically fish and row a canoe and just have a fun day. Yeah.
So what is there today? Something quite different.
Well, what happened was in 1902, the old Victorian building burned to the ground.
Hmm.
And nobody really knows exactly why. Was it an accident? Was it arson? Nobody really knows. The lucky thing was only one person lost their life in the conflagration, and he basically ran back into the burning building to retrieve his life savings.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, Ellen White and the Adventist Church decided, well, we don't want to rebuild in Battle Creek. We want to diversify and build smaller sanitaria around the country that'll be more cost-effective than this big old thing. Well, Kellogg would have absolutely nothing to do with it. And within 14 months, he'd completely rebuilt newer, bigger, better, the new Battle Creek Sanitarium.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a thoroughly modern, thoroughly fireproof building that had even, you know, greater amenities than the original had.
Wow.
And that building still survives. In 1929, they added on the Twin Towers, a substantial addition, which unfortunately opened its doors in 1929 just for the stock market crash. And so at that point, the sanitarium began to have real financial problems, and that's kind of the decline of it.
Mm.
But what happened was this main building complex was sold lock, stock, and barrel to the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
Which then used it as a army hospital during World War II. And you get famous people like Bob Dole and Daniel Inouye as patients spending a lot of time in the Federal Center. Well, the Army Hospital as it was then, the Percy Army Hospital. And then later on, as use changes, a number of different government branches have occupied the building. Such that today it's a logistical center for Homeland Security.
Okay. And tell us something about the brothers and where the serial part of the story, which isn't the main story here, but where it started. We talked about the vegetarian diet, how that led to that. But this brother actually seemed to kind of look down on that part of the operation, didn't
yes.
he?
Yes. Yes. Part of the problem was one of the charges of the Battle Creek Sanitarium was to create vegetarian foods that people would actually want to eat. Before then, one of the most popular vegetarian foods was invented by Sylvester Graham. And it consisted of, very easy recipe here, it consisted of unbolted wheat flour, so basically whole wheat flour, mm-hmm. coarsely ground. You add a little bit of water to it, you slap it in the oven, and you bake it for 5 or 6 minutes, so all the water's out of it. And there you had something called a Graham Jim, which is one of the most tasteless...
That doesn't sound appetizing
no.
at all.
They call them Graham Jims, and people ate them.
Not our s'mores of today, are they?
Well, they're the kind of, you know, great-grandparents of today's Graham crackers.
Yeah.
Only back then, there wasn't the sugar and the salt and the fat and all the wonderful things that make Graham crackers taste good today. But Graham crackers were designed to basically lower the heating of foods that you ate, and so in the end that they would not actually lead you to intemperance and lust.
Yeah. So what was the relationship between the two brothers, and how did that split happen, that one is health and religion and the other one is cereal? Mm-hmm.
Well, the story goes that Dr. Kellogg had a patient who was fond of the Zwieback, the kind of hard, crusty bread that was served. Mm-hmm. But one batch came out, and it was a little bit too hard, and she broke her bridge work on it. And she went up to the doctor and showed her the two pieces of her bridge and said, you know, if you're going to feed us this Zwieback, you're going to have to pay for my teeth. And so at that point, Kellogg decided, I need to come up with a vegetarian food preparation that is easy to eat, easy to masticate, easy to digest, but will also have a long shelf life. So those were the kind of criteria.
Okay.
So John Harvey, his wife, Ella Eaton, who had a big part of this, and his brother, W.K. Kellogg, got together and started doing these endless experiments on how to create a grain food preparation that would have all these constituent parts. Well, they started practicing with rollers, and they would basically soak grain. In the beginning, it was wheat grain.
Mm-hmm.
in these rollers, and then they would send the seeds through the rollers, which essentially would flatten them out. And they developed a process whereby they could take a butter knife and then scrape off what were essentially flakes.
Oh.
Well, part of the problem was, originally when they did that, they found that overnight the flakes would mold. And what they found, completely by accident, is if you expose the flakes to high temperature, baking temperature, for a few minutes,
mm-hmm.
Before you basically put them into storage, this tempers the flake and it won't rot. And that was the real breakthrough. And they found that people just love these things. They're easy to eat, they're easy to digest, they had a certain amount of flavor. Now Kellogg was interested in selling these through his, he had a couple of different health food companies associated with the sanitarium.
Mm-hmm.
And one was called the Sanitas Corporation, and this sold the flake cereals. And eventually they even invented a corn flake. That turned out to be a little bit harder. And that's something that W.K. Kellogg claims to have perfected, the corn flake. But Kellogg wasn't interested in marketing these things nationally. They were a nice way to bring money in. They're a nice way to advertise the sanitarium. But he had no desire to turn them into a mass market product. He didn't want the money. He didn't want the fame or notoriety. And he didn't want the negative publicity that might come back and sully the reputation of the Battle Creek Sanitarium.
Hmm.
So what happened was Will K. Kellogg really took the lead on marketing these products, and they insisted that they have the Kellogg name on them. But if you looked, it was always W.K. Kellogg. It wasn't John
right.
Harvey Kellogg, because W.K. can plausibly say that, oh, I'm not a doctor, I don't have any connection to the sanitarium,
right.
so this is not going to reflect badly on John Harvey.
Hmm.
Well, eventually what happens is after the burning and the rebuilding of the sanitarium, WK is getting very impatient because something happened in the meantime. A man named C.W. Post came to town, and C.W. Post came and stayed in the sanitarium for several months. Turned out he absolutely hated it, hated the vegetarian food, hated Dr. Kellogg, so he converted to Christian Science. And opened up his own rival Christian Science sanitarium, quote unquote, to basically put Dr. Kellogg out of business. Well, didn't quite work, but he was very interested, Post was, in making knockoffs of Kellogg's cereals. And so there was something called caramel coffee that Kellogg created that Post turned into Monk's Brew and then eventually into Postum. Mm-hmm. And then his flake product originally was called Manna from Heaven, but they thought that was too irreverent. Actually, it was called Elijah's Manna, and so he changed the name to that to Post Toasties, and he began marketing these things just left, right, and center, and nationally and internationally. And by the turn of the century, he'd become a multimillionaire. He was one of the richest people in Battle Creek.
Yeah.
And WK saw this, and he was championing at the bit. Why cannot we do this ourselves? But it was only after he broke with his brother in 1907 that Wilk was allowed to strike out on his own and create the Toasted Cornflake Company of Battle Creek and start his own enterprise. The problem was WK wanted to use the Kellogg name. John Harvey did not want him to use the Kellogg name. So for the next 10 years, the two brothers are fighting it out in court at great expense, and their relationship is getting worse and worse and worse. WK originally, in the end, wins. He wins the right to use Kellogg on his cereals. So he wins the battle, but he loses his brother. And until the end of their lives, they never quite reconciled. It's a sad story.
Yeah. Now, where things seem to, at least for me in reading the book, the story gets uncomfortable when Kellogg gets into eugenics.
Oh, yes.
And he really got passionate about this.
Yes.
So explain to us what eugenics is about.
Mm-hmm. Well, eugenics is the idea that human beings can control human reproduction in order to accelerate evolution and basically create a superior race.
Yeah.
And Kellogg, by the 1910s and teens, supports this wholeheartedly for a variety of reasons, both scientifically and religiously, as I talk about in the book. And he eventually becomes one of the major spokespeople for eugenics in the United States. Yeah.
Tell us a little about the research. I mean, this book is just meticulously researched. Did this take years, I assume, or?
Yeah, it's a little bit difficult to gauge. I started working on the book about 6 years ago, and originally, as we said in the beginning, it was primarily looking at Battle Creek in general, and Seventh-day Adventist and Dr. Kellogg would have been a chapter in the book. Mm-hmm. And then it became obvious that Dr. John Harvey Kellogg was really the key to understanding what was going on here, and so I started to focus on that. That was about 4 years ago when I really started to focus in earnest on John Harvey Kellogg. Mm-hmm. Now, the nice thing is John Harvey Kellogg wrote everything down, and there are records everywhere and depositories of records. So in our own archives here at WMU, there are records at MSU, the Bentley Library at University of Michigan, the Archives of Michigan, which are the state archives.
So if somebody wanted to, they could dig around and find some of the equipment, maybe tour the building, photographs.
I would suggest
all of this is available.
Yeah, all the archival material is in public hands, except for the material at Andrews University, which also has its archives. And they've always been very welcoming for me to come in and look at their material.
Yeah.
In terms of the kind of material culture of the Battle Creek Sanitarium, I would recommend people, it's a little bit of a rigmarole to do this, but they do give private tours of the federal building. Hmm. There's a certain amount of security you have to go through, and there's a certain amount of time you have to take to actually set this up. But the guides are highly knowledgeable. They're very friendly, and they take you into all sorts of wonderful nooks and crannies in the building.
I bet that's fascinating.
So much is left there untouched that you really get a feeling of what the place might have been like. Another place to go is Adventist Village. The Seventh-day Adventist Church has, for a number of years, tried to reclaim Battle Creek as one of their historical sites. And so off of downtown, you'll find several square blocks where the Seventh-day Adventist Church has either salvaged original buildings from mm-hmm. the time or built meticulous copies of buildings from the time. Ellen G. White's original house is still there and can be toured, and it's very interesting. There's also a very small museum. It's called the John Harvey Kellogg Discovery Museum. Run by a wonderful gentleman named Duff Stoltz. And Duff worked for the sanitarium for years, and when it was closing down, salvaged just a tremendous amount of exercise equipment and, pictures and chairs. And some of these things are on display at the little John Harvey Kellogg Discovery Center. It's well worth a visit. It's a lot of fun, and you'll see some of his more interesting inventions there.
So a good place to start is with this book. And where can we find this book, and where can we find more information about you and the book?
Well, happily, the book is available locally at Kazoo Books, our local booksellers. It's also available at Barnes & Noble and up in Grand Rapids at Schuller's. So if you want to do the local route, which I would like to encourage everybody to do.
Absolutely.
It's also available, of course, on Amazon for sale.
Any readings coming up?
Yes, actually, I have several coming up. This Thursday, so let's see, 2 days from now, 11:13 at 5 p.m., I'll be at the Barnes & Noble in Portage for a reading and a signing. Love to see a lot of people come out to that. Should be a lot of fun, weather cooperating. And then on Tuesday, 11:25, so that's the following week, at 6:30 p.m. up at Schuller's Books up in Grand Rapids. It's a wonderful bookstore, and it should be just a lot of fun. I'll be there actually with a number of different authors talking about our new books. So I'm looking forward to that. And then Saturday, December 6th, Kazoo Books is having their kind of author hop.
Oh, that's a lot of fun.
It is, yeah. And they get together a group of people, and it lasts the day, and we kind of overlap, and we come and mingle and talk about our books and just meet the general public.
So you can get your Christmas gifts for the history buff in your family.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So if you could give us just a small sample of reading from your book so people can see just how readable this is.
Okay. Let me read just the first paragraph or so from Battle Creek Beginnings, which is the introduction, kind of sets the stage for where John Harvey Kellogg came from. Part of his great achievement is the fact that he was born on the Michigan frontier, one of 16 children. Not seen in the beginning as the most gifted, and he was probably the shortest, but nevertheless, he managed to just make great achievements. So in the summer of 1940, at the age of 88, Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, seeking to record on paper some of the essential facts of his long life, cast his thoughts back to 1863, a time when Battle Creek, Michigan was a very small village of a few hundred inhabitants, and the great Battle Creek Sanitarium was still many years in the future. His mother, Kellogg remembered, had just asked the young boy what he wanted to do when he grew up, to which he promptly replied, "Anything but a doctor." Apparently, shortly before his mother's question, John Harvey and some other boys had pressed their faces against a neighbor's window to witness the bloody spectacle of a local sawbones practicing his art on one of their playmates lying on the kitchen table. In the wake of this episode, Kellogg remembered, I abhorred the medical profession, did not like bad medicine and the bloody surgery. That just a few years later, that young boy would find himself a famous doctor, and a surgeon at that, must have given the elderly Kellogg a chuckle. For in addition to his childhood disgust at the sight of blood, he had been, at the age of 11, nothing more than an undersized boy working in his father's Battle Creek broom factory, distinguished only by his exceptional manual dexterity in sorting out broom corn, and by the fact that his family belonged to a struggling apocalyptic sect, the Seventh-day Adventists. Significantly, Dr. Kellogg followed this memory with that of another. Shortly after his mother had asked him about his future in life, the boy had come upon her praying for his future. I went in and knelt down beside her, and she placed her hand on my head as we knelt there, and she dedicated me to the Lord for human service. From that moment on, the elderly Kellogg said solemnly, I have never had any desire but to do everything that I could for humanity. As immodest as this sounds to our ears, the statement was typical for Dr. Kellogg and Dr. Kellogg's self-understanding, and its conjunction with the previous memory signals something that Kellogg never doubted. His choice of the medical profession was not a choice at all, but God's choice, and his mission to spread the Battle Creek idea, or biologic living, was God's will. It was the product of a large ego, perhaps, but also the product of the peculiar sectarian hothouse environment of Battle Creek's West End, birthplace of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and Kellogg's home from the age of 4 until the end of his life.
Thank you. We've been talking with Brian C. Wilson about Dr. John Harvey Kellogg and the religion of biologic living.